No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it. Hello. No, You Tell It is a series that switches up the storytelling. So each performer writes a true life tale and then, switching with a partner, performs the other person's story, giving everyone involved the chance to share their own stories and experience someone else's. Welcome to our first Three on Tuesday episode featuring a tri-flip of storytellers who switched up their stories round-robin style as part of our Temper Temper show. Plus, Know You Tell It alum and friend Colby Black kicked off the evening with a special comedy set. Here is our full Temper Temper show, recorded live at Jimmy's Number 43. Since doing Know You Tell It over 2 years ago, Colby has started doing stand-up, and we have gone as a little Know You Tell It family and seen him do stand-up, and he has graciously agreed to come do stand-up for us tonight. And I wish that we were funded at a place that you actually had a mic to come do stand-up, but I'm going to put this mic stand here so that you just feel more secure.
Yeah. He's tall. You don't need to show it. He's taller.
Yeah, so that you can, like, we can feel reels. You can do this. So, everybody, welcome.
Kelly Jean, everybody.
Yay!
Is everybody ready for some great stories tonight?
Yes.
Is everybody ready for me in the meantime?
Yes.
Good. I don't know that I am. First things first, this is not my normal facial hair situation. I just want to address this. As you guys know, it's November, which means this is the month I moved to Brooklyn, so I had to go with the amazing, terrible facial hair. My girlfriend and I just fled the Upper West Side, where we and her dog were living in my 200-square-foot studio apartment, and the catch being they didn't allow dogs. So for 6 months, as we wrote out my lease, waiting for whatever might happen, we had this, like, weird Anne Frank Underground Railroad situation with the dog, where we would just sort of ferret him out and pull ninja stuff and odd Jedi mind tricks, where, like, the live-in super's wife was notorious and nosy, and she would catch us in the elevator, and she'd be like, "You would have no dogs here." And we're like, "There's not a dog." Good, we don't have one. Yeah. There were disguises, there were trench coats, there were shenanigans, and we're so happy to be in Brooklyn though, now. In a great place that's dog-friendly. I almost said dog-free. We don't have a dog. See, I can't stop playing that. So there's a bar in our new neighborhood, and I will name it by name. It's called the Dram Trap. I don't know if you guys know it. And I walked in there, and I was like, I want this to be my new local bar, right? I want to be a regular. I want them to have my keys behind the cash register so I don't get locked out. They're my place. So we went a couple times, and we went one day last week, and it was the day that it rained or whatever. And so the next day, I was looking around the apartment, and I said, where's my umbrella? And we should preface this. I have an amazing umbrella. Space age and shit, and it's got these gussets on the side that deflect wind, and, like, it also has powers to repel rain. Like, 90% of the time when I grab it, it ends up not raining, so it's, like, an amazing umbrella. And I got it, like, half price, and it was normally, like, way too goddamn much to spend on an umbrella, and it was merely just too damn much to spend on an umbrella, and I ended up buying the thing for half price, but that felt like a big win. And I love this umbrella, and I have dreams and goals and life aspirations for things to do with this umbrella and attached to it. And so we came back last week, and I said, "Sarah, I can't find my umbrella." And she goes, "You left it at the dram shop." And I went, "Oh, God." So I, in the parlance of my father, tore ass over to the dram shop. And I walk up to the bouncer, and I'm like, "I left my umbrella here yesterday." And the guy did not share my sense of alarm about this. One bit. He's like, "No, no," he points back, and so I go to the bartender and I go, "Hey," and I was hoping to find the one that we'd seen the day before, and I go, "Hey, I left my umbrella here." She's like, "Tell me about it." I go, "Well, it's a black umbrella, but it's big and it's long and it's really space age and shit and it repels rain and it's got magic powers and stuff." Give me a second. She looks around for, like, Harry Potter's umbrella, doesn't see it. She pulls out this, she goes, "We don't have it, but here's one we've got," and it's this really shitty, gimme free umbrella with some corporate logo on it that was also black, but whatever. And I'm like, "That's not it." And she goes, "Well, you can take it instead." And I was so insulted, more than she had just, like, whatever. So I'm like, "I don't want your umbrella. I want my umbrella." And I bid them good day. And I spun on my heels, and I got to the front door, and I pulled my phone out, and I got on Twitter. And this is right in the theme of Temper Temper. I immediately could not wait to fire off an angry tweet, which is how I now lose my temper, generally. And I will quote this. At the Dram Shop BK, they're the sort of people who won't do the right thing and return a beloved umbrella. Hashtag, fuck 'em. And I felt good. And I sauntered home in the parlance of my father. And it took like 20 minutes or whatever, so the two it took me to get there. I took my time, and I get in, and I take off my hood and sweatshirt, feeling all proud of myself, and I go to hang it in the closet, and I look down, and there's my umbrella.
Oh, no.
And I was so happy, because I'd forgotten what I'd done 20 minutes ago. And so then it was like pulling my pocket off to get the phone out, being like, oh my god, my bar where I want to be local, I just told them, hashtag fuck them. So I got to delete it. I haven't been back. So we'll see. But I think it's a major step forward for me just losing my temper on Twitter now, because I used to lose my temper sometimes in person. And here's another thing. I used to be a really, really huge Texas football fan. Some people that know me find that statement probably pretty funny because they think I still am. But, like, no, I used to really, really be a huge Texas Longhorn football fan. And there was one year, it was 2000, and I still lived in Austin, and the original Alamo Draft House was showing Texas football games on the big screen. And we were playing Stanford, and we'd beaten them by 52 points the year before. And in the year 2000... such a heady time, the year 2000. We're ranked number 5 in the country, and we're rolling into Stanford, and we beat them by 52 the year before, and I was confident this was finally our year. And we go to the game, and oh, one thing. The game was sandwiched between double features of Quentin Tarantino's Blood and Gore Fest, where Quentin Tarantino had curated 2 B-grade movies to show, like zombies and gore and blood and all that stuff. And so... that this sandwich between the two of them. We go into the game, we're in the theater, we're watching it, and Texas is laying eggs left and right, and they have 10 penalties and 4 turnovers and 2 blocked punts, and in spite of that, we managed to like fight back and get a lead in the middle of the fourth quarter. But also, I was doing a lot of nervous drinking that day, and they kept showing Tiger Woods in between like every play as a Stanford grad, because he was the best Stanford grad they could find, I guess. And this was just incensing me. And I don't want to say like I was drunk and obnoxious, because I've made much better efforts in those fields before and after, so I don't want to just paint with a broad brush. So anyway, the game starts getting out of the final couple minutes. I can't take sitting in the seat in the theater and watching this anymore. And I turn to my friends and I say, I'm going to go watch this on a little TV in the lobby. So I go out there. We're up by 4. Stanford driving on the field. Our safety, whose name I'll never forget, Joe Walker, had an interception, hit him right in the hands, and he drops it. 2 plays later, he misses a tackle in the open field. Stanford scores and wins the game. And now I like to flip this story to the perspective of my friend Michelle, who comes around the corner to look for me / check on me, who sees me and spots me. It's easy, not just because I'm really tall, but because it's the people are lining up for the second half of Blood and Gore Fest. So everyone else in the lobby is wearing solid black and super pale and pasty and all into zombie horror movies. And then there's me, and I'm in an orange shirt, and there is like a penicillin ring around me where people are giving me space, and I'm staring at a TV on the wall and like screaming things. And I think there may have been spit flying. I don't know. And so anyway, she rounds the corner right as they throw the touchdown and wins. And in her words, what happened was, I tore my shirt, my polo shirt off of me, much like Hulk Hogan. However, with more skill, I came over with it and drop kicked through the air. And as I did, probably the most amazing thing I've ever done in my life, like a physical sense, right? I could never do that. As I did this, I screamed something like, "You son of a bitch!" in the middle of a quiet theater lobby. And as I finish, and my shirt's doing that, I realize I'm like 9 inches from Quentin Tarantino's face. and he is aghast at the cursing display that I have just put on. So there's a pause, there's an awkward, and I stuck my hand out and I said, "Mr. Tarantino, you've influenced my life in ways you can't imagine." I don't remember if he shook my hand, but I do remember scooping up what was left of my shirt and taking myself out the door. And I am convinced that eventually there will be a Tarantino movie where there's someone in the background not even relevant to the action going on, and they're just screaming at a TV while a sporting event is happening, and that will be my contribution to American cinema.
Can't take credit for Colby's creative talent, but we do like to take advantage. So thank you so much, Colby, for coming to our show. So now I'd like to introduce the three storytellers from our tri-flip to the stage. Elizabeth Yeager, Gloria Beth Amadeo, and Morgan Pielli. One thing that we like to do at No You Tell It, this is my favorite thing because I'm kind of a secretly mean person, is we... I'm an openly mean person that likes to put people on the spot, is not only is this the first time that you're hearing these stories that didn't even really exist. A month ago, these storytellers all met each other for the first time and brought in their first draft, and we met in a small room that, you know, my friend gives me for free. Everything, it's New York, so the theme is small. And we huddle in a conference room and give each other feedback, and the authors get two chances to revise before turning over their draft to their partner. And tonight, just like you guys, they're hearing it performed out loud for the very first time, which is why the mean part of me likes to put them on stage so that you can watch them watch their story being performed for the first time. And right before we do that, we'd like to get to know the author a little bit before their partner performs their story. So we have a little fun Q&A section. And so we do this a little differently every time, and this time I've come up with individual questions. Sometimes I rip them off the internet, but those are personalized questions for each of you. And in one of our story sessions, Beth, you taught me a very important tip or rule. So I, as Erica knows, I keep leaving things in my apartment on, like the toaster, or the hairdryer, the oven, and been wondering if there are or not. So Beth taught me that you should always, when you turn something off, clap three times so that you remember that you did it, so that you don't have to send your friend home in a blind panic to see if you burned your apartment down and your cat's still alive. So I was wondering if you had any other great tips for anyone who might be a little neurotic out here that you've discovered over the years, like that one, like any neuroses survival tips.
Oh my
God. Came up with that amazing one.
I'm definitely neurotic about things. And yeah, that was, that one, I actually read about that on the internet. I searched how to make sure you turn your stove off before you leave. and that one said clap three times or say something I turned it off. Just look at it. So yeah, I would say just remind yourself mentally, snap, clap.
The clapping
whistle.
Works, I have to say.
Yeah.
I did it before the show today.
My
hair straightener is off and my hair looks great. And the apartment is not on fire. So with that, our first story of the evening is The Worst Lie I Ever Told, written by Gloria Beth Amadeo and performed by Elizabeth Yeager.
The Worst Lie I Ever Told. Megan Haddock and I sat cross-legged on the carpet of Mrs. Lowry's first grade class and waited for the other half to join us for story time. She wore jeans and I wore a dress. She was blonde and I was a brunette. I told her that I had a secret, speaking so softly that she had to lean forward and ask me to repeat myself twice. "A secret?" she whispered. "Yeah," I whispered back. "It's a big one." She leaned in. "What is it?" "It's so secret, you can't tell anyone. I promise I won't. Not even your mom. I promise, just tell me." I first learned that Megan would believe anything in the field at recess, somewhere in the shade of our favorite maple tree. We turned that tree into a different building every day. It was a castle. It was a grocery store. Sometimes it was the entrance to heaven. Megan threw herself into the world we created, and we'd have to reach in and pull her back, reminding her that it was pretend. "I'm an angel," one of us would say. And Megan would say, "You are?" She'd been to my house once or twice for playdates, meeting my older brother and baby sister, and I had been to hers. She was the type of friend who let me pick the toy I wanted to play with first, and who let me make up the rules for every made-up game. It's been 25 years, and I'm still not sure why I lied to her that day on the carpet. It wasn't premeditated, nor was it something I wanted to be true. The only requirement I had in the moment was it needed to be outrageous. I wanted to see her believe something totally unbelievable. "Okay," I said, gearing up. "My brother, are you ready for it?" I am. Just tell me. "All right. Well, my brother has." I waited a few seconds. Megan was staring at me, mouth agape. I had her. "My brother has a glow-in-the-dark penis." I contrived the entire story in that moment, and it was not difficult to convince Megan of its utter truth. My main task became answering all her high-level technical questions. I see it every night. It floats around the house. "Sure, you can come sleep over and see it. I'll ask my mom." "No, you absolutely cannot touch it. It only trusts me. It'll zap you." She believed everything with no reaction other than conventional surprise. "Oh, wow, it floats? That's great! I'll definitely sleep over." "Yeah, okay, I won't touch it. Yeah, I don't want to get zapped." But then our teacher began reading to us, and I stopped thinking about it. And I didn't think about it again for an entire week. It's these types of memories that make me worry about my head. Years of babysitting have taught me that children are obsessed with bodily functions, that poop and pee are their favorite forbidden vocabulary words. I know they love to shock and surprise and slip genital anatomy into unrelated conversations. A kid once told me a knock-knock joke that went like this. Him: knock-knock. Me: who's there? Him: poo-poo. Me: poo-poo-hoo. Him: poo-poo-penis. But I have yet to meet a child who's told me anything that reaches the level of floating, glow-in-the-dark penis that I achieved at the tender age of 6. When my mom found out I was eating chicken nuggets at the kitchen table, the phone rang. "Hi, Mrs. Haddock," she said. And I thought I'd be invited over to Megan's house for a play date. And then my mom said, "Beth told Megan what?" I should have known what she was talking about. But in all honesty, I had completely forgotten. I was scared. A week felt like a month in those days, and I couldn't remember for the life of me what I could possibly have said to Megan that would cause our mothers to speak on the phone, and my mother to sound so alarmed. After my mother hung up, she sat next to me. "Now, Beth," she said, seriously, "I'm going to ask you a question, and I need you to tell me the truth." I nodded. "I'm not going to be mad. Please just tell me the truth." I nodded again. "All right," she said. "Did you tell Megan Haddock that your brother has a glow-in-the-dark penis?" I nodded once more, this time vigorously. That was it? Yes, I did that, I said. Okay, my mother said. Well, we need to go over to the Haddock's house. Megan's having nightmares. And you need to apologize and tell her that it isn't true. That there's no such thing as a glow-in-the-dark penis. The word nightmares made an impact. Mostly because I realized that Megan was having actual nightmares because of something I said. Was she having nightmares about penises? Were they glowing? Were they attached to people or were they floating? Exactly. How much of my story made it into her nightmares? But I also felt bad about the fact that she was having nightmares. I had nightmares before, and they were terrible. I once watched an episode of Walker, Texas Ranger with my parents and dreamt for a week straight about people hanging from bridges with nooses. My main fear was losing Megan's friendship. I liked playing with her. It was the first time I had ever done something that could make someone not like me anymore. It was then that my 9-year-old brother came in from the other room. What are you guys talking about? I'm sorry, honey, my mother said. Beth told Megan Haddock that you have a glow-in-the-dark penis. My brother was quiet. What? Why did you do that? He asked. I don't know, I responded. And I felt my first bit of real remorse. The skin on his brow crinkled, eyes falling to the floor. And I realized that it was his body part that I had been telling lies about. I saw something on his face that I had not felt before. Embarrassment. Up until that moment, I thought that what I had done was innocuous. I thought it was just a silly story that I had made up about a penis. And I didn't even think about it affecting anyone. But then I saw the collateral damage on my brother's face, and I felt sad about that. Perhaps a little shameful. How do you process shame at 6 years old? I don't think you do. I think you suffer it and stow it away for a moment like I'm having right now, retelling the story and realizing that my shame in that moment was quite possibly also my first roundabout experience with empathy. But I did not know what these things were back then. All I knew is I needed to get into the car and go to Megan's house and tell her the truth so she would stop having nightmares. I was on a mission during that car ride led by my mother, the arbiter of wisdom and conflict resolution. Left to resolve the situation on my own, would I have known what to do? My best guess is no. I would have forgotten that Mrs. Haddock had ever called and went back to giving my Barbie dolls haircuts and getting upset when the hair didn't grow back. We arrived and Mrs. Haddock welcomed us in. She didn't seem angry. Neither did Megan. Our mothers talked and I told Megan the truth. It was make-believe. It isn't real. My brother doesn't have a glow-in-the-dark penis. Megan accepted my apology, and we played on her swing set. It's okay, she said almost thoughtlessly, much like I had been while telling her the lie, focused on the next movement, play more important than any judgment we could hold against each other. She forgave me like a child for something I had done like a child, and I didn't think about the worst lie I ever told again until my mid-20s, when the retelling of it became funny to others, but still creepy to me. What was wrong with me, I asked my mother on the phone once, genuinely concerned about these behaviors and if they had anything to say about my present mental state. You were just very imaginative. Do you ever want to bring me to a doctor? No, of course not. There's nothing wrong with you. It's possible that her insisting on this logic has made me what I am today, a writer of tales that are, in their own right, just as bizarre as my penis lie. And if that's the case, then I'm glad she didn't bring me to a doctor for a brain scan. I'm glad she protected my imagination, directing it away from Megan Haddock and into drawings and stories on our Windows 95 word processor. I'm glad she read and printed all of them out, using encouragement to preserve a piece of the child I wouldn't be forever. Writing is still fun because of that preservation, because of that six-year-old inside with a secret to tell.
Our second story this evening is going to be performed by Gloria Beth, but it was actually written by Morgan. And Morgan is one of the other ways people to come to know you tell it, which is that I slightly stalk people that I find interesting and, you know, wonder how they would fit in the mix. And so luckily, Morgan was very amiable to my stalking.
Sure, I didn't know about it.
Now he's going to reconsider because he's like, whoa. So the question I came up, it's a two-part question that I came up from you, is that I think of you more, as I stalked you, it was through the more storytelling world aspect. So I was wondering how your background, like how you kind of moved from, like what was the connection to telling stories through comic art and now on stage as a storyteller?
A part of it was just wanting to get better at the structure of storytelling, but the largest part of it was I had terrible stage fright for a long time, and it was completely unconnected, and I had done improv, and that made it worse, because you have, like, no guidelines, and I discovered storytelling, like, oh, I know what's happened to me, I'm just gonna get on stage and say it, and that's quite easy, and then eventually, and then people started laughing, which made it even easier, with me, not at me, and then that kind of, yeah, and that helped me get over my stage fright, which you may or may not see on display when I get to read.
And you have one of the storytelling shows is, as you can see from Morgan's bio, that he does a number of different things, but the one that I got to see recently was Relationship, where you actually do storytelling, and then the last storyteller is the, how did you phrase it?
The Annalee. That's a word that we made up for the show. We have them sit down with a panel of four experts, myself, my co-host, and two real-life therapists. And they're therapized on stage for the.
They are. And the one I saw Friday had a great line where she said, like, the New York itself is an abusive boyfriend. So
yeah, that is an absolutely accurate description of New York.
So I wonder if there was something about being on the storytelling scene or trying to, you know, work as a comic artist and graphic artist in New York, like, was there something that, about the abusive nature of all of our lives that you're like, I've got to work therapy into a show?
Oh,
like, where did the idea come from?
It was something that Lynn and I, my co-host, had talked about doing because we were both the product of many failed relationships with interesting relationships with our family and parents. And we were both in lots and lots of therapy. And we're both in New York just being browbeaten with its New Yorkiness for 10 years. It just seemed like a natural thing to kind of come out of that.
Thanks. Well, before we hear Morgan's story, I just want to tell everyone in the back, there are some scattered seats. I'm very Italian and guilty, and so if you want to come up and fill in anything, feel free. We're all a family. There's one next to Alex. But I'm very excited to hear the next story, which is Midget, written by Morgan Pielli and performed by Gloria Beth Amadeo.
Midget. I've always been short. As a child, I was promised a growth spurt by parents and doctors that never came. I was sent to a pituitary specialist to determine if my body was broken, and if so, what chemicals were needed to fix it. But nothing was wrong. I was simply a runt. Under 5 feet, under 100 pounds, under everyone's thumb. Our seventh grade homeroom teacher was Mrs. March, a fussy, middle-aged woman with tight, curly brown hair who never seemed comfortable around children. Each morning, she grumbled her way through roll call and bustled us out the door. However, one morning, she announced that we had guests. Mrs. March gestured towards a pair of little people standing at the doorway. The man had curly blonde hair and glasses that were too large for his squat face. The woman had sharp features and wore a red dress with white dots that unfairly reminded me of Minnie Mouse. I shot a careful glance to Rebecca Palesi. We were the two shortest people in homeroom, so we often got teased together. But we weren't friends. She was very quiet and looked away when you tried to catch her eye. As the class runs, we tried to be invisible in our own ways. I sat on the far side of the room, engrossing myself in some doodles. Rebecca sat along the opposite wall, staring forward, motionless. Mrs. March continued her introduction. The little people were here to talk about tolerance. Tolerance! At first I was filled with hope. Surely they would go from classroom to classroom and make everyone realize that size doesn't matter. We learn to love one another for our differences. You know? Like adults do. As the guest's presentation began, snickering began deep within the mass of stone-faced children. Mrs. March pretended not to hear as the presenters plowed on. I grew uncomfortable in my chair, sympathetic as a fellow little person, though not literally. I'd managed to sneak a glimpse at the pituitary specialist's height chart. It was a silent point of pride that my representational graph line always clung to the bottom edge of the average range. The snickering grew louder. I looked at the clock, counting minutes. If the little people finished quickly, I could slip out the moment the bell rang and leave this failed experiment in tolerance behind. But at the end of their presentation, an activity was planned. The male little person had been born with dwarfism, where an individual has disproportionately sized body parts. He had the upper body of a full-sized man, but with short legs. The female little person, however, was born what is now derogatorily known as a midget. This is when a person is proportionately smaller than a full-sized person. She had the same physical proportion of a full-grown woman, only scaled down. Yet, despite these differences, the man and the woman were the same height. To better demonstrate, the presenters invited us to the front of the classroom, one at a time. Standing in front of the class was always mortifying, but there was something else. Something no one else had realized. Something horrible. An alphabetically unlucky Eric Baird was first up. He was directed to stand beside the female little person. She was indeed proportionately shorter than Eric. Next, Eric stood beside the male little person, towering over him due to the dwarf's unusually short legs. Finally, Eric was shown to a pair of folding chairs off to one side. The male little person sat in one and invited Eric to sit beside him. Now, the male little person sat significantly taller than Eric, as though Eric were beside a full-grown adult. The benefit of my last name, Pieli, is that it puts me close to the end of most roll calls. But this only served to protract my torture. More students went up. Tracy Berkeley, Eric Cameron, each stood beside the female little person, then the male. A prickling heat went up my neck. Bob Henderson, Bill Johnson, each sat beside the male little person. I held my breath, willing homeroom to end. Melanie Klepper, Kathy Lundgren. As the class moved through the alphabet, I managed to catch Rebecca's eye. I saw the briefest flicker of fear before her eyes darted away. She had the same terrible realization. Morgan Pieli. The class went silent. The realization spread instantly outward, followed by snickers. Mrs. March demanded quiet as I made my feet heavy as soaked clay clomp forwards. The snickering grew louder. Mrs. March hushed the class sternly, sending their jeers inwards rather than away. Feeling hollow, I stood facing their terrible smiles. Rebecca looked away. The male little person cleared his voice to speak. Once again, notice how this student is taller than... He paused, looking over the top of my head. Laughter erupted. Morgan the midget. Shoulders heavy, I stood before the class, shorter than even the two littlest people. But a presentation is a presentation, and the public humiliation of a child is no reason to stop the terrible momentum. Now, if you'll come trudged to the pair of folding chairs and sat in defeat. The man with dwarfism sat beside me, tall as a father. Yep, he declared with a faint nervous flutter. I'm, still taller. Then it was Rebecca's turn. I looked on red-faced as she quietly floated to the front of the class. She stood beside the woman. Laughter. She stood beside the man. More laughter. As she sat in the folding chair, a new realization radiated outward from the meanest children. Pielli and Pelesi, the midget couple. Look at them! Smaller than the real little people. Morgan and Rebecca were made for each other. At last, the bell rang. Mrs. March thanked the speakers for their time and shooed us briskly out the door. Rebecca and I split off in the direction of our respective classes, never speaking of our shared humiliation. We'd been made into toys for the classroom, defined entirely by our size. Later that year, I found myself in the cafeteria with one of the other runts of our class, the round-faced Joe Boothby. It had been a long year for us both, and we'd taken our share of shit because of our height. As a girl, Rebecca was mostly ignored. Girls are supposed to be small, the thinking went, but not boys. So Joe and I, standing roughly the same height, found ourselves trapped together on the very last rung of the social ladder. While this made us almost friends, any chance to move up a rung presented had us scrambling over each other to get to it first. Our relationship oscillated between dull camaraderie and bitter rivalry. Joe and I sat nursing chocolate milks on a pair of seats at the end of a crowded table. Apart from being short and male, we had little in common, so our conversation was superficial. Television, video games. Then Joe made a joke about my height. It was stupid and offhand. Had he said it earlier in the year, I'd have ignored it or come back with a dig of my own. But many months of harassment and humiliation came crashing together. Tiny Morgan, puny little Morgan, Morgan the midget. I leapt at Joe, but he was too fast. He sprinted the length of the cafeteria, cackling back at me gleefully. I clumsily charged after him, chasing him in wide circles around the edge of the cafeteria, faster and faster, shouting insults and threats at the top of our lungs. We attracted the attention of the whole school, the attention from Nate Carpenter and his tall, mean friends near the doors. Nate was interesting. He had light brown hair cut into spikes, with a scraggly rat tail in back. He was also, by far, the shortest boy in school. One might assume this would make him even less popular than myself, Joe, or Rebecca, but the opposite was true. If you're going to be something unfortunate, it's best to be the most unfortunate. The novelty of being the shortest afforded Nate immunity from the usual humiliations. He quickly became a mascot to the tall, mean boys. Also, Nate was an asshole. Yeah. That helped, too. It was Nate and his friends who tried to shove us in the lockers, who sneered at us, spat at us, who knocked our books to the ground and kicked them down the stairs. As Joe and I passed Nate and his tall, mean friends, they started cheering us on. The midgets are gonna fight! Battle of the Shrimps! Beat the shit out of him, Morgan! Turn and fight, Joe! You can take that midget! The next period bell chimed, and Joe and I burst out through the cafeteria doors, up the greasy hill towards the flag football field. Our faces were hot and wet as we screamed insults back and forth. 400 students poured out after us, led by Nate and his tall, mean friends. At the crest of the hill, Joe turned to face me, grabbing the front of my shirt. I grabbed his collar with one hand, his arm with the other. A massive ring of students formed around us, blocking the view of any passing faculty. They cheered for a fight, cheered for blood. Nate and his tall, mean friends circled us like lion tamers. A carefully placed insult here, and I yanked Joe off balance. A surgical taunt there, and Joe shoved into my chest. A prickling heat went up my neck. What had been the casual stupidity of two desperate outcasts had become the focus of the entire school. Shame, fear, and anger welled up. Shame at having lost control. Fear of my first fight. And anger. Anger at everything and in every direction. The prickling spread, searing from my shoulders to my hairline. Joe had a wild look in his eyes, like a cornered animal. We yelled and postured and tugged at each other's limbs as our eyes searched the crowd for a way out, for a teacher to stop the fight, for Nate and his friends to get bored. Joe caught me looking past his shoulder, and for the first time since the chase began, our eyes met. I didn't want to fight him. He didn't want to fight me. Nate and his tall, mean friends had toyed with us, used our insecurities to manipulate us into becoming their entertainment. My grip on Joe's arm relaxed. His grip on my collarbone softened. We stopped circling each other. We stood looking sheepishly at one another, panting for breath. Joe reached out and I took his hand, shaking it. Together we turned and walked with all the manufactured calm we could muster, past Nate and his tall, mean friends. Through the perimeter of the circle and down the greasy hill, Nate yelled after us, "Pussies! Scared little shits!" Because remember, giant asshole. The ring dispersed with murmurs of disappointment, and Joe and I headed for class in different directions. Though we remained almost friends, we never talked about the fight. I don't think either of us wanted to admit just how close we'd come to letting Nate and his tall, mean friends make us hurt each other. How close we came to once more letting our size define us. The funny thing is that it's ultimately time that allows us to define ourselves. More than any number of Nates and his tall, mean friends ever could. In fact, Nate, that asshole, is now a pretty decent guy. He became a mechanic and has a wife and son. Sometimes I chat with him at the park. Joe moved to Florida a year after the fight. He changed his last name and went to live with his dad. It happened so fast that there was only time for a hurried goodbye. Rebecca quietly graduated and just as quietly floated away. A search for her name yields zero results. She's defined by her absence, I suppose. It's been more than 2 decades, but once again, I'm standing before a room full of people. Once again, I'm on display because of my height. But this time, it's by choice. This time, it's not defining me. Here I am, all grown up at 5'4". Woo!
Performing the last story of this evening, but going back to where, well, we're right back, you know, full circle, literally, we're going to hear a story that's written by Elizabeth Yeager, and Elizabeth and I both are part of Fairleigh Dickinson University's MFA program, which is how we met, although I don't think we were there quite at the same time. I do think I remember sitting at dinner with you
when I graduated.
Yeah. So we almost shifted the night, and luckily we did get to meet each other for a brief moment when we came and did a Know You Tell It show as part of the summer writing residency out at FDU this August, and Elizabeth came up after me and was like, "I am in." So I wanted to know, having been part of that program myself, like, just from your perspective, what was seeing a Know You Tell It show like after being at those writing residencies, and what was it about it specifically that made you run up to me after, and then again when we spoke at the Brooklyn Book Fest, and are you regretting it now?
It just looked so much fun. I was like, I want to be in it. And then I got home and realized that I have stage fright. So here I am.
Yeah, apparently all of us have stage fright. Do you have stage fright? So you're like the anchor for us today. The rest of us. I had 3 glasses of wine. So that took care of that. But did you have as much fun as you thought it was watching it?
Yes. And in fact, it wasn't. It's not just. Kaylee told me that the whole workshopping process was going to be wonderful, and it really was. You could really see the work progress, and it was fun, the whole process, not just tonight.
This has been great for me, too. So what you guys might not know, too, is that each of the storytellers had a one-and-a-half-hour rehearsal with a member of the Know You Tell It creative team on Sunday on each other's stories. So a lot of hard work went into this, and actually I wasn't part of that this time, so it has been amazing for me to hear, even since our last session, how much the stories have leapt forward and then the performances. So I will put you out of your misery and let you take a seat, and we're going to hear Genuine Demon, written by Elizabeth Yeager and performed by Morgan Pielli.
genuine demon. I'd say it was like fireworks, the way they detonate in the sky, bursting and crackling into oodles of colors. The sound deafening, thunderous, but fireworks are pretty and celebratory. I need to find something more indicative of pain. Something dark and ominous, destructive. Perhaps dynamite is a better metaphor. The heat starts in my throat. I can feel it sizzling, spreading down my arms and my hands. My face burns and my fingernails claw at the top of my skin to stop it. I clamp my lips shut, but the velocity is too swift. The anger explodes out of my mouth. Once ignited, the dynamite rips through my body, destroying all of other emotions. Love, compassion, and understanding become casualties. I see myself as through a window, a portal from a saner place. And I hate myself. The fear in my child's eyes, the disgust in my spouse's face implore me to stop, but I'm not me. And the me that is screaming, the me slamming doors, is a force beyond my control. I hate what I see. I hate who I have become in that moment, for I am cruel, impassioned, and unreasonable. But there's no way to stifle the fury. It lasts a few minutes or close to an hour, and when the rumble finally subsides, leaving me spent and weary, I assess the damage. Apologies flowing like rivers. But hugs can only absolve so much. Medication prescribed to stabilize my moods can diminish the sensation, lengthen the fuse, and dampen the explosion. But 7 years ago, when I began trying to have a baby, I stopped taking my medication. From the start, I wanted to be a good mother, and I didn't want the toxins to injure or impair my child. 2 weeks ago, I picked up my 5-year-old son from his school in New Jersey. At dismissal, the doors slammed open and dozens of happy, screaming kids rushed outside. Usually, my child emerges with a smile, jumping into my eagerly awaiting arms to give me a hug before asking if he can go to the playground to play with his friends. But on this particular afternoon, there were tears in his eyes as he fell instead of jumped into my arms. "What happened?" I asked, immediately concerned. He hadn't cried once since starting kindergarten. His lower lip quivered as he spoke. "Mama, why was I punished?" He buried his head in my neck, the weight of his pain pressing down on my collar. "What happened? How are you punished?" I felt the spark as the fuse caught, fire raging in my chest. If he'd been reprimanded at all, his teacher or the principal would have contacted me. "I didn't get to go to recess." His voice was barely audible, lost in the cotton of my shirt. "Why not? Recess was my son's favorite part of the day. And the fact that it had been taken away enraged me. Mrs. Jones told me I had to read with her instead. My friends got to play, but I had to read. Why?" He lifted his head, his moist brown eyes glistening in the sun as they searched my face for an answer. I could feel the rumbling in my chest, the spark and sizzle of the fuse as anger surged through me. Ever since my son was a baby, books were an important part of our time together. Every night we'd cuddle in bed, my arm wrapped around him and his head pressed against mine as I read book after book. We'd look at the illustrations, discussing the stories, and laughing at quirky characters until his eyes grow heavy. Even then he doesn't want to stop and give up the stories for sleep. After reading to him, I tell him stories of my own, ones I've made up and stories from my own life. His love of books and stories was so great that shortly after turning 3, I started to teach him letter sounds so that he could begin sounding out words. By the time he was 4, we'd sit on the couch together in the morning, and he'd read to me. He started with Dick and Jane, and has recently fallen in love with Mercy Watson. Reading is something special that the two of us share. And I'd specifically requested that the school respect his love of reading by not making his lessons redundant. Instead, they were threatening to destroy his passion for books. "They weren't punishing you," I said, trying to soothe his disappointment. "They're just incompetent." "But I won't let it happen again, I promise." Later that night, when we as a family sat down to eat, I turned to my child. "Tell Mommy what happened today at recess." Her sparkling blue eyes turned to ice, and the fuse within me ignited as we watched our son crumple beneath the retelling of his tale. He's in school for 6.5 hours, and the only block of time they can find to educate him is during recess? I spat my words, my face contorting in disgust. That's totally unacceptable, Katie, my spouse, agreed. In early September, Katie and I had met with Ms. Barker, the director of instruction in my son's school. She informed us that, based on the results of a standardized test, our son was above grade level, but just barely. I had wanted him to visit first grade for reading, so he wouldn't be bored in class, but she claimed he wasn't reading well enough. I debated the legitimacy of basing the decision on one test. I am a certified elementary teacher with several years of experience teaching children how to read. I know what my kid is capable of doing because I read with him every day. Eventually, Barker and I reached a compromise. Starting in October, my son would be pulled out of class 3 times a week to join the lowest first grade reading group. I wasn't completely satisfied, but I hoped that in time, the reading teacher, Ms. Jones, would get to know him better and realize that he wasn't being challenged enough where they'd placed him. But October came, and still my child wasn't getting any reading instruction. I complained, wanting to know what happened, and Ms. Jones informed me that my son was actually reading better than the students in the lowest first grade reading group. I found no surprise there, so move him up, I insisted. She shook her head, refusing to concede even on a trial basis. Instead, she promised that she'd work out something in the next week or two. That something turned out to be having my son miss recess. It's totally unacceptable! I felt the blast within, fury surging through every limb. The reason he didn't score well on the test to begin with is because he didn't know how to take a test. He'd never taken one before. I agree, but school is all about testing. You know that. But it's not right! I slammed my fist down on the table, the wine glasses pinging in response as wine sloshed over the sides. I despise standardized tests. They had plagued me my entire life, labeling me as having less potential than I really had. When I was in elementary school, I was placed in the second reading group instead of the first because my test scores. And when I got to high school, I was originally forbidden from taking honors English and history classes because my test scores were deplorable. I didn't want that for my son. I didn't ever want him to feel stupid because of a test. It's infuriating that because Barker's married to the test scores, our kid is sitting in class, not learning a bloody thing. Why bother sending him to school? Calm down, my spouse ordered, knowing full well that when I was fired up, calm was impossible. I'll call Barker tomorrow. The following afternoon, I was not far from my kid's school when my phone rang. I'd gotten there early to pick him up, and I was taking a walk around the bike path while reading Tom Sawyer. When I heard my phone ring and I saw that it was Katie, I slammed the book shut, anxiety swelling in my gut. So what did Barker say? I snapped. Katie plunged into the crux of it. She said that there's a new girl in the class who's almost at his level. They're going to put him in a group together. Ms. Jones will work with his classroom teacher to ensure that they are being challenged at the appropriate level. The fuse burned in my lungs, detonating the dynamite immediately. That's totally unacceptable, I shouted in the phone. I was irate that my son would end up bored in school, the one thing we'd hoped to avoid. He was assessed lower than his ability. Now they want to put him with someone who's almost at his level? That means this new kid is probably nowhere near him. This is a fantastic opportunity for her, but a waste of time for him. Barker told me that he will learn, that come June he will still be above grade level. Of course I seethed. He will read better because I will continue to read with him at home. Why are you yelling at me, Katie demanded? We can't force them to do something they don't want to do. And they're going to teach him, just not as much as you want. Katie tried to rein me in. She tried to twist my mind into seeing things less emotionally. But rage blinded me. The dynamite destroying my ability to think rationally. They lied to us once, I screamed, my voice echoing off the trees. They had it their way. Everyone would wait to catch up to him so that their lives would be easier. That's not right. Katie made one final attempt to quell the fury that consumed me. We can't change the system. We can't force them to do something they don't want to do. But our kid is smart. He likes school. Don't upset him. Don't ruin school for him by letting him see your anger. He have to adapt. I'm not adaptable! I can feel the veins on my neck popping as my scream reached a frenzied pitch. I slammed the phone shut, shoving it deep into my pocket. With the steam still coming out of my pores and the flames raging in my heart, my child was dismissed from school. In his backpack, I found a letter that set off the next several rounds of dynamite. The top of the letter read, "Calling all dads." It then went on to invite fathers to volunteer to help with a pumpkin carving activity. My fury multiplied exponentially. First, the school refused to place my child in a challenging academic environment. Now they were discriminating against him. "This is totally inexcusable," I shouted to no one in particular, crushing the paper in my fist. "Mama," my son's quiet voice broke through my anger. "You can still volunteer, can't you? You have short hair and you wear boys' clothes. I can call you Pa and no one will know that you're really my mother." The pain of exclusion should have been his, but he saw through it, around it. "Yes, I will volunteer." But the following morning, I could find no release from the anger provoked by the actions of the school. While my son sat in my lap reading Amelia Bedelia, he neglected to accurately sound out the word genuine. In doing so, it was as though he ignited another round of dynamite. The fuse was short, my rage was aimed at the school, but the impact slammed against my son. "Why can't you read?" I shouted. "Why are you going backwards? School should be making you smarter, not dulling what you already know." An activity that we enjoy, one that usually creates a sense of security and togetherness, had turned into a torturous task for my son. I was doing exactly what I condemned the school for doing. They deserved my anger. My child did not. Tears filled his eyes, and he didn't want to read anymore. The rational me, the me that looked on, unable to stop the monster raging within, begged the crazed person I'd become to stop. But once the dynamite explodes, it is impossible to contain, burning, scarring, ravaging everything in its wake. It wasn't the first time that I hurt him. It wasn't the first time my temper sparked fear and anxiety. And when the ruins of our morning lay smoldering around me and I could feel the cruelty of my viperous words, I hugged my son, rocking him in my arms as I apologized. How many times can someone say they're sorry? I've tried to change. I've promised him and myself numerous times that I won't scream anymore, that I won't get angry. But it's a promise I'm powerless to keep. I've been a good mom, sometimes, but I've also failed my son. On some days, most days, I look into his eyes and I see them glowing with love. There are moments when those same eyes tremble with fright. Lately, I fall asleep at night with those eyes haunting me. If I were to die tomorrow, which me would he remember? The real me, the me that loves him dearly and would do anything for him? Or the interloper, the me that spirals violently out of control, unable to apply the brakes or pull away? Initially, I'd stopped taking my medication for the well-being of my child. After he was born, I wanted to believe that I wasn't sick, that I could function like a normal person, that I could be free of medication and still lead a productive life. I didn't want to admit that I was broken. Looking back over the pain I've caused, I realized I was wrong. I'm not a bad mother, but to be genuinely good, I must confront the lies I told myself. And so for my son, so that I can stop inadvertently pushing him away, and so that I can begin to model proper behavior, I accept the fact that I need help. I've gone back in my meds, and the rage that had consumed and defeated me for so long has finally begun to relinquish control. And when I look at my son, the smile on his face, and the joy in his eyes when we are together, I know that I've done the right thing.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of Know You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.